This is The Health Show, a presentation of National Productions.
Surprising reports have been coming in over the past 6 months or so about people contracting disease from dirty or reused needles. The surprising part is these are not IV drug users. These people are medical and dental patients, and the injections were from healthcare professionals.
Both healthcare providers and patients need to be aware of this small but potential risk.
On today's Health Show, we'll talk about the state of injection safety in the U.S.
We'll also hear about a new HIV/AIDS drug that's being touted as a way to prevent infection with the virus. And we'll find out which California city is becoming the Golden State's pot capital. I'm Dr. Nina Sachs.
I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Health Show. Last week, a former lab technician at a New Hampshire hospital was arrested and charged with infecting 31 people and exposing possibly tens of thousands of others to his hepatitis C by injecting himself with single-use fentanyl syringes, then refilling them with saline solution, and then they're used again. This year, there have been some other major investigations launched into possible disease outbreaks caused by unsafe injections by healthcare professionals. It's a problem that has many people scratching their heads wondering, how could this be happening? Here to shed a little light on the topic is Dr. Guthrie Burkhead, Deputy Commissioner of the Office of Public Health for the New York State Department of Health. Dr. Burkhead, I think many people are wondering what's going on, that this was a problem that's already been solved.
This has come about because we've been focusing much more attention on diseases like hepatitis C and have discovered that some small portion of hepatitis C cases may be related to misuse of injection equipment in medical settings. And we've been focusing much more attention on it because we think both healthcare providers and patients need to be aware of this small but potential risk and what the steps are that can be taken to avoid it.
Now, what exactly is the problem? When we think of injection safety, we, of course, think of IV drug users sharing needles. But this is something that is happening in medical settings.
What seems to be happening is that healthcare providers, in rare instances, are using sloppy technique with use of what are supposed to be single-use syringes, IV tubing, IV bags, and medication vials. It may be partly just a lack of an awareness and also a lack of appreciation that even small amounts of contamination can lead to particularly hepatitis C virus transmission. So, for example, if you injected a medication into an IV tubing that was attached to a patient, you might not think that that was creating a problem with the syringe that was doing the injecting, but actually any IV tubing in touch with a patient's blood is assumed to be contaminated. So that syringe, which is in touch with the IV tubing, if you were to go back and put it back in a vial of medication to draw some more medication and then use that same vial on another patient, you could potentially contaminate it down the line.
We've spoken on the program a lot about the current shortage in prescription drugs and drugs in medical settings. Is this somehow part of the problem where single-use drug vials are being used more than once just to kind of stretch the supply?
Well, actually, I think this practice predates even the current shortages of drugs, and I think there's a natural tendency, if you have a vial of medication that's not finished, to then go ahead and use it with the next patient, and that can cause problems, particularly when medications are labeled as single use. One problem it's created is that single-use medication vials don't have preservative to prevent bacterial infection, and so we've seen a number of instances where reuse of medication vials that were intended for single use have caused bacterial contamination and infections. But there are safe ways, if you wish to save medication that is labeled for single use, there are safe ways in a pharmacy, in a controlled environment to split those doses up. But once you have a vial like that in a patient setting where you're removing doses and giving them to patients and going back and forth, that should probably not be used for another patient in that kind of a setting.
Researching the problem, does there seem to be any particular pattern? Is it like, I've read that anesthesia seems to be a particular problem with this.
Right. I think we're seeing it particularly in outpatient settings, not exclusively, but we have a big tendency now to do procedures like colonoscopies and catheterizations in outpatient settings where there may not be a pharmacy on site to prepare the medications. So it's either related to the anesthesia or to the injection of medications, contrast material for x-rays. In fact, injection of medications for cancer patients and other things. One of the very largest, one of these outbreaks around the country that was identified was in a cancer clinic where they were using large bags of saline fluid and basically taking saline out of the same bag all day long. And at some point in the day, that bag got contaminated and contaminated everyone down the line. So it's not just anesthesia, but we certainly have seen it in those settings as well.
Are there other diseases besides hepatitis C that people are in danger of catching?
Yes. Other what we call bloodborne diseases can be transmitted by contact with blood. The other main ones are hepatitis B and HIV, the virus that causes AIDS. We've seen fewer of these kinds of outbreaks related to HIV, I think in part because it may not be as contagious as hepatitis B and hepatitis C. But those are the main viral infections. And then, as I mentioned, it is possible through contaminating medications, vials that don't have preservative, to have bacterial infections occurring. And we have seen recently infections related to injecting medication into eyes and ophthalmology clinics that were related to bacterial infection of the medication by repeatedly re-entering the same vial. The rubber stopper basically breaks down and you can get bacteria growing in the medication, actually, which then gets injected into the patient. So not a good situation.
There's been some MRSA infections on this way, hasn't there?
Yes, I think so, as well as other kinds of bacterial infections.
Yeah. Again, we mentioned the New Hampshire outbreak. Another situation that came about recently was a dentist in Colorado.
Right.
Who many of his, years and almost over a decade of his patients are being asked to be tested. And that really harkens back to the Kimberly Burgalis case with David Acer back in the 90s, where probably the most well-known case like this.
Right. This particular dentist was reusing needles and syringes repeatedly, often over several days, to prepare injections and give injections into patients. And so that's clearly a major risk. So up at this point, I think about 8,000 of his former patients have been tested, including patients all over the country.
Are there inspections for this? I know for restaurants, they have health inspections. Are there something, to make some inspections that come in that make sure doctors are following procedure?
I think in general that in health facilities, there are accreditation processes, and for ambulatory surgery as well, there are accreditation processes, which should be looking in general at infection control and preparation of medications. I don't know whether those inspections always get down to the point of observing what's actually going on. So I think it's more dealt with on a complaint basis. When we have a problem, you go in and really look at how people are handling it. But there are accreditation processes that definitely cover infection control and safe injection technique.
So if you're a patient, how can you protect yourself? Is there anything you can do besides just asking the question every time you're going to get a shot?
Well, I think that is the thing to do, and what we're trying to do through our New York One and Only campaign is get physicians, medical providers aware of this issue, but also encouraging patients to ask. And that may seem at first difficult for people to do, to sort of question, whether their doctor is doing something safe. But I think if you look at it in the context of you're a patient going in to get a medical procedure and you want to ask a lot of questions, the trend these days is for people to take a much greater interest in the care that they're receiving. And so you'll have a number of questions about the procedure and the potential risks of the procedure. And in the context of that kind of a discussion, I think the question of going to be using single dose vials, syringes and tubing that haven't been used elsewhere, right? Checking on your infection control practices as part of the overall education of the patient about what's going to happen and what the potential risks are. And in that way, raise the issue and have the provider say, oh yes, we will be following safe injection techniques. And to get them to think about it a little bit.
Dr. Guthrie Burkhead is Deputy Commissioner of the Office of Public Health for the New York State Department of Health.
Still to come, there's a new drug that's being touted as a breakthrough in AIDS prevention. That's next on The Health Show.
You can find The Health Show anytime online at healthshow.org. Search the archive and listen to whole programs you may have missed or would like to hear again. Even subscribe to our podcast. That's healthshow.org. You can also follow us on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/thehealthshow.
You can start your own Health Show archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for Health Show number 1270.
This is The Health Show. I'm Bob Barrett.
And I'm Dr. Nina Sachs. It is being called a major development and a milestone in the 30-year fight against HIV and AIDS. A new drug called Truvada is a medicine that is being touted to help prevent the transmission of HIV. To learn more about this drug, The Health Show's Brian Shields spoke to Dr. Douglas Fish, an associate professor of medicine at Albany Medical College and chief of the Division of HIV Medicine.
Well, it certainly is a new era. This is the first drug that we now have FDA approved for people who do not have HIV infection to prevent them from acquiring it. The data comes from two very large trials where this drug, Truvada, was studied. The first was a study in the United States of about 2,500 HIV-negative men and transgendered women who have high-risk sex with men. And the other was a study of discordant heterosexual couples, largely done in Africa, where one partner had HIV infection and the other partner did not have HIV infection. And in the first study, among men who have sex with men, there were 42% fewer infections acquired when Truvada was used. And in the heterosexual discordant couples trial, risk of HIV infection was reduced by about 75%. So these are enormously successful numbers in terms of reducing numbers of new infection that occurred. These were placebo-controlled trials. They were done with all the standards of care that we would ordinarily use when prescribing medications, including education about condom use, and this was recommended. Condoms were provided. There was a lot of education that was done in addition to just the medication therapy.
How does this work, basically? What is the gist of this medicine? Does it create a barrier of sorts?
It does. We have been using it for many years in occupational and prevention. So a healthcare worker who might get a needle stick from someone with HIV or an unknown source or an unknown HIV status to try and prevent the acquisition of that infection. But this is the first for prevention, really, of sexual transmission in a what we call pre-exposure preventive way, so that the way the medication would work is the person would take it once daily, in addition to using condoms, in addition to practicing safer sex, to try and prevent HIV infection. The problem is that currently we still have over 50,000 new HIV infections each year among adolescents and adults in the United States. And it's been that way now for more than 10 years. So we need additional tools to try and prevent some of the new infections, and this is one of those.
Is there a risk to this medicine in that some people will hear that it's out there and so I can drop the safe sex, I can drop some of the precautions that have been around for the past 20 or 30 years?
Sure. That's certainly a concern. The trials have not borne that out, however, and the issue certainly need to be followed as this therapy gets implemented and there's wider usage. But thus far in the clinical trial data that has been presented, this had not been a major problem, nor has drug resistance. People were concerned that this might breed HIV drug resistance. However, if you don't get HIV infection, you're not going to be breeding resistance. And in fact, when HIV infection did occur anyway, there was very little evidence of drug-resistant virus being spread.
Are there side effects?
There are potential side effects. Nausea, headache, loose stools on occasion. And we have to be particularly careful in people who have kidney problems. And in fact, if people have significant kidney disease, then they could not take this preventive therapy because it is metabolized and has an impact on the kidneys.
Now, this is not as preventative, say, a vaccine against polio. Most of those are 98-99% effective. How effective is this?
Oh, that's true. There were prevention rates from 42% to 75% in the trials. However, it also will significantly depend on how well the person taking the medication adheres to taking it every day. What we know from the trial in men who have sex with men is that the average prevention rate was around 42%. However, if people took 90% or more of their doses, the effective rate increased to about 73%. So it will depend significantly on how well people take their medicine. This is not what we call a point-of-sex drug. This is not the drug to take the night before you're going to go out, but it needs to be taken consistently on a daily basis in order to be effective.
Is it more effective for certain groups, for men or women, certain age groups?
We don't know that. It seems to be equally effective across the age groups and individuals studied. It is FDA approved for age 12 and older, so it has not been looked at, you know, at younger ages, particularly for this indication.
Certainly, this medicine has been in the works for many years. This type of medicine always is. So, what do you see next coming?
Well, I think there will be more data coming with this particular therapy and perhaps other medications. The other thing that is really happening is this concept of treatment as prevention. So for people who have HIV infection, getting them diagnosed, getting them on treatment, if we can suppress their viral loads, and we usually can, to undetectable levels, then the risk of their transmitting it to partners goes down significantly. And so one of the newer concepts is this treatment as prevention, not only for your own health benefits, but for the benefit of your partner.
AIDS has been part of the national consciousness now for some 30 years. Where would you put it right now as far as the fight against AIDS and HIV is going?
Well, I think you're right. It has been 30 years, and there have been enormous strides. And we really tend to think of it now as more of a chronic but manageable illness. It does not have the mortality that it once had, although it still can be a fatal disease. If people get diagnosed, get on therapy, we now are planning, based on our modeling of our currently available therapies, planning for people to have normal life expectancies into their early 70s.
Dr. Douglas Fish is an associate professor of medicine and chief of the Division of HIV Medicine at Albany Medical College in Albany, New York. He spoke with the Health Show's Brian Shields.
Marijuana is legal for medical use under California law, but sale and possession are still federal crimes. Raids on growers and dispensaries and a general climate of uncertainty are increasingly creating problems for the industry. In the Bay Area, downtown Oakland is such a noted center of cannabis activism that a section of the city is known as Oaksterdam. Oakland's largest dispensary is a few miles away from downtown. Steve D'Angelo is the executive director of Harborside Health Center, which claims to be one of the largest cannabis dispensaries in the state. Stephen Short has more.
Hey, Jeremy, how's things going in the nursery?
Everything's going great, Steve. Our supply is up. Everybody is ramped up and ready to go. I don't think we're going to have any supply issues this year.
The slogan of Harborside Health Center is, "Out of the shadows, into the light." It's a philosophy that Executive Director Steve D'Angelo takes seriously. He says he got the idea from his building designer. She suggested he put windows in the sales area, something he had never seen in a dispensary.
I sort of had a double take, and I was like, why not do that? I'm not doing anything illegal. I'm not ashamed of what I'm doing.
And he never has been. D'Angelo has been a marijuana activist since he was just 16 years old. He helped plan the first hemp museum, he organized a traveling hemp tour, and he worked with author Jack Herrera in the publication of his book, The Emperor Wears No Clothes. This book is still cited by pro-hemp and pro-marijuana groups over a quarter of a century after its publication.
I always knew that I wanted to be an activist for social justice.
These are not idle words. D'Angelo has been an activist since he was a boy.
In 1971, at the height of the Vietnam War, I organized an occupation of our junior high school gymnasium. And we held that gymnasium for a whole day, and I think made a very effective statement about the war.
Lessons from such early activities stayed with him and helped lead to his life's work.
I found that many of the other issues that are dear to my heart, like democracy, individual liberty, compassion, equality of health care, all are impacted by cannabis activism.
While living in his hometown of Washington, D.C., D'Angelo was deeply involved in the 1998 political campaign to legalize medical cannabis there. The initiative passed, but was overturned by the U.S. Congress. By this time, California's first medical marijuana law was already in place, so he decided to, shall we say, move to greener pastures. He co-founded Harborside Health Center after receiving a cannabis dispensary license from the city of Oakland in the fall of 2006. Earlier this year, the FBI raided Oakland's Oaksterdam University and forced a number of dispensaries throughout the state to close. That may have been surprising to some, but not to Steve D'Angelo.
The very first day that we opened our doors here at Harborside, there were DEA agents raiding medical cannabis locations in San Francisco and in Oakland. And we opened our doors that day. Since then, I've never known when I come to work in the morning whether I'm going to go home at night or whether I'm going to be taken away in handcuffs.
Harborside's location could keep it off the DEA's radar. It's not near parks or schools or residential areas. Furthermore, it's operating within the city of Oakland's guidelines for cannabis dispensaries, as well as state regulations. While Harborside has yet to butt heads with the DEA, they are fighting tax claims from the IRS. That agency says the dispensary owes millions in back taxes. Harborside contends that they wrote off legitimate business expenses, such as payroll and health care costs. But the IRS says that's not legal, because Harborside is selling illegal drugs, which it is, under federal laws. One of the main concerns behind federal crackdowns nationally is what officials might call the migration of cannabis from medical use, which is regulated in several states, into recreational use, which is not. Many activists are working towards getting recreational cannabis legalized, but D'Angelo thinks that's misguided. He doesn't even accept the idea of recreational cannabis. The plant, he says, is neutral. What varies is how people use it.
I believe that cannabis can help inspire people to make creations, which can be part of a recreational activity. But it's not the cannabis itself which is recreational. The cannabis is playing a wellness function, which enhances or enables recreation.
Now, wait a minute. I have to ask you about that. I mean, the typical stereotype of somebody who's been smoking or eating marijuana, their response to that would be, what? You know, it's supposed to slow you down. You're drugged now. So that's the opposite of what you just said.
Some people believe that cannabis just makes you spacey and that you wouldn't be able to create anything when you were using cannabis. But if you go back and look in history, you find that remarkable artists from Louis Armstrong to the great Sufi poets of the 7th century all speak about how cannabis has inspired them, has enabled them to take the stage and give tremendous performances. So, in fact, cannabis is really a great aid to creativity. That's why musicians, writers, painters, and performers have always loved cannabis.
Like many advocates, D'Angelo can cite a long list of positive aspects of cannabis, including this one.
One of the well-known benefits of cannabis amongst regular users is that it tends to promote forgiveness and understanding. And so cannabis can be a powerful tool to conflict resolution in anything from business disputes to lovers' quarrels.
This forgiving attitude will no doubt prove useful to Steve D'Angelo as the legal wrangling associated with his industry continues. In Oakland, I'm Stephen Short.
That's all the time we have for this week's Health Show. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at healthshow.org. You can explore the archive for any programs you might have missed or would like to hear again. You can also subscribe to our podcast. That's healthshow.org.
Want more? Then follow us on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/thehealthshow. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is letters@healthshow.org.
I'm Bob Barrett.
And I'm Dr. Nina Sachs.
Stay healthy and be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Health Show.
Dr. Nina Sachs is a practicing member of the American College of Gastroenterology. Bob Barrett is producer of The Health Show. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Health Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content.